For WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for joining us. Last summer, I ran our Community Agenda Initiative, asking residents what they thought our city council election should be about. We're running it again this year, by the way, for state and local officials, and we'd love your response if you want to fill out the survey online at whqr.org. But last year, during the council election, a few top priorities became immediately clear: development and affordable housing. Now, opinions varied, but they were very strongly held, and yes, plenty of people opposed development, period. And that was across the political spectrum and all over the map of New Hanover County. So to talk about development here in the Cape Fear, I'm bringing in News Director Ben Schachman, who's reported on this issue for many years in New Hanover County. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kelly.
So we've both taken note of this peculiarity with development. It's not exactly partisan, even if it's a strongly held conviction by politicians and residents on both sides. So who are some examples of that?
Well, on the pro-development side, we've seen the Cape Fear Housing Coalition, which is generally known for its support of affordable housing and rental protections and other kind of left-leaning issues. But they've tiptoed into support for non-affordable projects as well, like the development on Oleander and Independence that City Council approved this week, although not without a fight. But we've also seen politicians like Democrats Bill Sappho, Kevin Spears, Clifford Barnett, and Jonathan Barfield similarly support an increase in housing, alongside Republicans like council members Luke Waddell and Charlie Rivenbark, plus former City Council candidate John Lennon, who's currently on the City Planning Commission, and County Commission candidate John Hinnett. I'd say that the caveat here would be that these folks would probably all say, yeah, they support smart development, as in they seem likely to listen to planning staff when they say a project makes sense or doesn't based on the plan.
Right. And for pro-development people on the left, it's usually about supporting low-wage workers with more housing supply or creating more density within the city to promote walkable, bikeable neighborhoods, while people on the right might focus more on development as a boon for the local economy or just purely to support property rights for the developers who own that land. Often, the right is in favor of workforce housing developments, where local government might subsidize apartments that are affordable to police, nurses, and other first responders.
Right. Although we should note, as we've talked about on this show, it's fine to be specifically concerned about low-income housing or workforce housing, but it's all interconnected. So I know some folks are just mad at, like, luxury apartments. And that's an easy boogeyman to get mad at. But it's also part of the housing stock that our region needs. Otherwise, those potential high-end tenants just move into mid-price units and push those residents out. And you see where this is going. And we'll have links on the page to explain the rest of this. But in terms of opposing development, we've also seen liberals saying they don't want development because it harms the environment, like City Council members Celette Andrews and David Joyner, and conservatives saying they don't want to see the character of the community change into something unrecognizable. That reminds me of County Commissioner candidate Tom Tobey from a couple years ago, or current Commissioner Dane Scalise, who has sounded increasingly concerned about overdevelopment. And obviously, he's campaigning right now, and it's hard to say this isn't a motivating campaign issue. And it's hard to say this isn't a motivating campaign issue. And there's definitely people who would be happy to hear him say, quote, "We don't need to rezone every inch of New Hanover County," as he did at this week's commissioner's meeting.
The majority of our local officials, I would say, try to say yes to development when it makes sense and say no when they think it's out of bounds. Where they fall on that depends a lot on their personal experiences and sometimes based on how loud and well-funded the opposition to a particular development is.
Yeah. I will say, if you look back 5-6 years at the rezoning of the Avenue and Center Point, those are major mixed-use developments on Military Cutoff Road, officials seemed a little less fazed by the outcry. But I think some of our more recently elected officials are a lot more sharply aware of how that outcry plays at the ballot box these days.
What I've certainly noticed is how large numbers of angry residents showing up can often scuttle a rezoning request or turn votes against it. When the development seems particularly controversial, politicians sometimes bend to the will that they hear in the room, even if staff say that development does make sense. We saw that with that development on Independence and Oleander, which had full-throated support from staff, but dozens showed up to oppose it. That could be what pushed council members Celette Andrews and David Joyner to vote no.
I mean, again, people do get emotional about this. It's their home.
I get it. Wilmington was a large town for a long time, and now it's become a mid-sized city. There are benefits that come with that: new entertainment options, food, shopping, economic opportunities. But you also see more and more housing being built to accommodate the people moving here.
And when you put together strong emotions with an incredibly complex system for city planning, that leaves people feeling disenfranchised from the process. That's a nice way of saying people are really angry. And when you're angry, it's easy to fall into misinformation. And we've definitely seen some entities weaponize that anti-development sentiment for political reasons. Even the media has used it to get a few outrage clicks.
That's why I recently dug into development and tried to inform the public about how it works. I produced a series called Development 101 that digs into this process and what topics come under consideration when developers seek rezonings and permits to build. But I wanted to allow those who are concerned about development to directly address their questions to the people in power. So I invited a concerned resident into the studio to get her perspective on it. And later this hour, I'll bring in a member of the City Planning Commission to face the music.
Well, Kelly, thanks for continuing to dig into this complicated story.
Thanks, Ben. Let's hop into that first interview. All right, my guest is Julie Hurley, who is a local concerned resident who wanted to talk on development. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, of course.
So I brought you here to share your opinions because you reached out to the station. But before we get into your concerns about development, I'd like to hear a little bit about you personally. So can you tell me how long you've been in Wilmington and what you do for a living?
Yeah, my grandparents are from here, and so we grew up summers coming and then have been full-time property owners here with my husband and my son about 21 years. So, yeah, I'm an educator and also do some property management currently, kind of switching hats from education to property management.
So what are your concerns with development writ large?
I've been here, a long time. I'm 60 now, so I've seen all the boom and bust cycles. Really love all the expansion that we're in right now. It's really exciting because what comes with some of the growth is also vitality. And I love that our community is expanding and we've got more restaurants and shopping and just really feels vibrant to me and like a very vital community. And I'm super excited about that aspect of growth. So I'm not anti-growth at all or anti-development. But there are some things that are happening in the development cycle that I just wanted to look at because during this boom time right now, I'm wondering why we are doing so many apartment complexes and also clear-cutting to make that happen and clear-cutting a lot of the projects, actually. I just seeing 60 years here, we natural spaces and green is part of what we're used to and smaller scale. We're kind of a big town, small city. And that scale is, if you look at some of the Southern Living and best places to move, when we're rated number one, it's partly for our natural beauty and also for kind of the, not only the vitality, but also the scale of our town. And I'm seeing that change quite rapidly, suddenly. And I guess we were with, friends all the time, the moms, all the baseball teams and all the people standing around complaining, and including me. And so I was just complaining to my husband, and he said, stop complaining and go see what's going on. And so that's when this is a couple months ago, I just started kind of looking and researching.
So, yeah. You mentioned earlier that your husband told you to go and do something about it. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you got involved in looking into this issue and what your involvement has looked like so far?
Well, I think the main thing is just listening to community, listening in. I feel like their representation is not in the room. So I started going to council meetings and talking with staff and just saying, can you explain how this all works? And then your 101 series was useful. And so listening in at those meetings where citizens are just, I mean, the boards and staff are completely tone deaf. You hear all this great science brought forward and you hear, just the flooding maps and permanent flooding. But that's OK. We're going to build anyway. And we'll pay for the taxpayers will pay for the infrastructure, even though that will cause harm to our community and the environment. It's by right and property rights. And I was like, yes, I'm all for property rights. And there's still some disconnect here where all this data and science gets presented. And then the board has a conversation that's like not reflective of what got presented. Instead, it sounds developer in favor of development. And it's possible that just because like that institutional knowledge thing, developers are on these boards and wherever, but the relationships are really close and maybe too close and too stacked and not balanced. And so the consideration for me was going to observe what was happening in those rooms because I've never as a citizen in all these years participated. And I thought, you know what? Don't complain if you don't even know what's going on. So I started just showing up at meetings, even though I didn't always know what was on the agenda or what the issues were. I would just like listen and watch. And one thing I did notice is staff and boards and attorneys and developers all have the same, they're on the same page. And it looks like staff is almost advocating for developers. Not exactly, because they're still just humans doing their technical job. So I don't mean to throw them under the bus at all. But it just, there's some development heavy thing going on. And it's probably in the water. It's probably in the background in our area. But I don't understand it. And so I'm still trying to figure out what's going on.
Staff do kind of advocate for development in specific situations. You'll notice the staff reports will say staff recommend approval staff don't recommend approval.
Yes, yes.
And so the answers will look a little different depending on where they skewed on that. And they have a whole complicated analysis around it.
Yeah.
But your point about developers being on these boards is something that we hear from a lot of concerned citizens. It's often these appointments, right? Some folks appointed to the planning board at the county or the planning commission, the city level, are involved in development or have been in the past or understand it for some reason.
Yep.
And then there's our elected officials, and there are people involved in development or real estate.
Real estate, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Charlie Rivenbark, who's involved with Cape Fear Development. We have Bill Sappho, who's a known real estate and developer. Luke Waddell is also a real estate agent. That's for city council. And then over at the county commission, similarly, we have Rob Zappel, who's a local developer. Jonathan Barfield is involved in real estate. So this is a very common trope. And there's definitely some factual evidence to back that up.
Yeah. And I just think that even if anybody doesn't want to be cited either way, if the developers are the people, if the staff is interacting with development requests and et cetera, that's who they're interacting with. They're not interacting with the citizens. You know, it's sheer exposure. Their exposure is to the development community, and their bosses are connected to the development real estate community. It's like an echo chamber. And so then potentially the comprehensive plans reflect that, potentially the interpretations reflect that. And so I just feel like I know we have got this workforce housing, affordable housing thing. We've got to get on that. But that needs to be its own plan and not brought up reactively for every rezoning. So some developer can say, oh, I put in three units for $300 less for 5 years. So now I'm going to have unlimited. I think we've got to like separate that out. And I'm going to ask JC if she could speak to that. So
absolutely. So I'm just sort of wanting to drill down on this a little bit. The main thing that you're seeing that you're concerned about is new apartment buildings going up in previously undeveloped land.
That's not the main thing.
Oh, that's not the main
not
thing.
The main
What's
thing.
The main thing you're concerned about?
Well, no, there's not one main thing. It's the rapid development, and it feels to me now that I'm looking under the hood. So I was trying to back up to the beginning of me getting started looking at this, was seeing the apartment complexes. But at this point, now I'm like doing research, I'm attending some meetings, I'm meeting with planning staff. I have to say the planning staff have all been just wonderful to take time to explain to somebody, just a regular citizen, a layperson who doesn't even understand this. But I just wanted to understand why this was happening this way, and especially when I'm hearing from community that they don't like it. So they're displeased with it, and uncomfortable with it, and yet it's still happening. And why is it happening if it's not the will of the community? So I was trying to figure out what the disconnect was. And so that actually would be my main concern, is the disconnect about how it's happening.
I'm curious, what did you find out from planning staff?
Planning staff is awesome. I've really had really great support, and they are great at the technical, and that is really their job. But one thing I've also heard from individual meetings with them is their clients are the developers and their bosses are the boards and the commissions or councils. And I didn't really hear us being figured into it in a big way. So as far as citizenry, let's just say. So that gap. The other thing that I could hear attending some of the council meetings or commission meetings, I'm hearing attorneys and developers and staff refer to the comprehensive plans. So one thing regarding the interpretation of the comprehensive plan, and we've heard it interpreted quite often and used as high intensity, mixed use, high density. Equally so in the plans, I can find specific language and specific line item codes that talk about character preservation, aesthetic preservation, having things be continuous and congruent with adjacent neighborhoods. But then we see these final projects and they'll just strip out all the trees all the way and put up this big high metal thing next to what used to be a different aesthetic. And that is an interesting thing. I don't know if what's happening and what we're seeing in this town matches the vision of the staff and the board, because I've not asked. But they do often say, oh, this is what citizens want. They made this plan high use, high intensity mixed use. But when I talk to citizens, I mean, I beg you to find one that says, we love the way that looks. We want to look like Charlotte. Please denude all the land and cut all the trees. You're not going to find it. But yet that's what's happening. So where's the gap?
I think comprehensive plan, my understanding is that that's kind of the idealistic future
guide. Yeah.
Guide.
Yeah,
and guide. Then there's the zoning map for what's currently the law. So
that's correct.
Often when you go to some of these planning meetings or if there's a rezoning under consideration, what you'll see is that a developer is asking for a lower level of intensity to be turned into a higher level of intensity for development. And they'll often reference the comprehensive plan. And when the comprehensive plan matches what they say they want to do, they're more likely to get that rezoning passed. And if it doesn't, they're less likely. But sometimes it can still happen, often because the planning commission or those boards will just say, we need more housing to address the housing crisis. So that's often a pattern that I've seen.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
When it comes to the intensity of development, you mentioned that you're concerned about buildings going up near single-family neighborhoods that are much more intense in usage than that. Can you talk about why that's a problem?
Well, I don't know if it's exactly a problem, but aesthetically, there's a visual change. And then use, there's a visual change. So impacts to the neighboring community. I've never had it happen to me. So I'm not like complaining about it as in my backyard, because I've just never had that happen. But I'm watching neighbors and neighborhoods, and then I'm listening to everybody on the ball field. And just needless to say, even though I'm not personally haven't been affected, it does look like a change of use of what's happening in a neighborhood. And the impacts of light, sound, pollution. I mean, I know we need to build out our city center. I know we need to create these more walkable, accessible zones. But I think we can do it, and I'll have my remarks for JC at the end. But I think we can do it differently than ad hoc reacting to individual project proposals as it is right now. It's very reactive is what it feels like.
I guess I'm curious. So you say you think it's happening kind of piecemeal, but that is kind of how it has to work. Since the city doesn't own and the county doesn't own these properties, it's individual owners who are coming forward and seeking these redevelopments or new development.
Yeah. I'm all for property rights. Absolutely. You should be able to do what you want to do with your space. You know, looking at this, some of these people that are applying for rezoning are not necessarily from our community. There's investments coming in from out of town and just seeing it as a quick turn. So that's different than a local community member developing with our community in mind. But I don't know if you remember back in the day, we used to have old school maps where we'd say, okay, this is exactly where we're going to put a bunch of, there's going to be all the amenities here, and here's the high intensity, and here is the mixed use. This is more ad hoc. They're like going into the back of a neighborhood right behind a house and putting in something that's four stories tall with a lot of traffic. And that doesn't make sense to visually to my eye. And now I'm hearing from people who have had that experience, there's not enough transition, especially if you look at the county and they're like, oh, a road could be a transitional piece. A fence is a transitional piece. That doesn't keep somebody from looking down into your backyard when a four-story mixed-use building goes out behind you.
Yeah.
So it just seems like we're greenlighting a lot of things reactively because we didn't in advance say, you know what, everything here probably needs to be two stories or under.
What kind of transitions would you like to see?
Well, of course, green buffers, always. Because this is what I love here so much is all the green, right, and all the trees. And so I would love, a large buffer. I mean, 25 feet. And I think the aesthetic piece is something to consider. So something more aesthetically visual and buffering for neighbors, for light, sound, pollution.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's get to this final piece now. JC Lyle is the current head of the Planning Commission at the city, and I'm going to be bringing her in for an interview after this.
Okay.
I'd love to hear what you'd like to say to her, or if you have specific questions you'd like me to bring to her. What are they?
Well, I think what I want to understand is, I don't know, I think we should decide in advance where rezoning can't happen and where it can happen. And right now it's rezoning every single project that's getting rezoned. Of course, the loophole for the developer is instead of making money on 60 market price / luxury units, I'll give them 3 token affordable workforce housing. Then I can go up and out and I can do unlimited density, so the bonus density thing. And then also if you put a little commercial in, then all of a sudden you go up four stories. So to get that full height and so they can make more money, they're already making plenty of money, but now you can even make more money. And I like making more money. It's not that. It's just the cost and the impacts to the community. And right now what we're working with is super favorable environment for the developers. Staff, commission, that some of them are development connected, and institutional knowledge is needed. But they're stacked boards, stacked commissions, stacked councils, and people are very often connected to the industry too heavily. We need a little more citizen representation. Where's the sustainability head on the council's board and within staff? So I would like to see how she would address that and what she would bring into balance and how would she close the loopholes, almost like falsely using affordable housing or workforce housing. Give a few little units so that you can expand from 60 to 180 and get unlimited. Those are loopholes that I think I'd like to see if she would address how she would close those.
Well, Julie Hurley, local concerned citizen, thank you so much for your time on this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
When we come back, we'll bring Julie's concerns to J.C. Lyle and hear from the City Planning Commission's perspective. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for staying with us. We just heard from local resident Julie Hurley, naming several questions and concerns she has for the Planning Commission. I also heard from other concerned citizens by email and pulled together some tough questions. So let's bring in our guest.
Thank you, J.C. Lyle, the current chair of the Planning Commission for the City of Wilmington, for joining me for this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So just to start out, I would love to have you explain what the role of the Planning Commission is.
Sure. The biggest value that the Planning Commission brings to the city is to review proposals before they go to City Council. We bring various backgrounds and professional expertise so that we can take our own look at the proposals for rezonings before they go to the council and make recommendations based on our professional experience, based on how they meet the codes or don't meet the codes. But we don't make any decisions. We make recommendations to the city council.
But you do that based on what you hear from staff as well as from developers and from the community at large, right?
That's right. We take the staff recommendation very seriously because they are the ones that are in it full time, every day, all day. And we add our experience to it and look at the land development codes, look at the comprehensive plan, which was done in 2016 with the help of everybody in the city to see if it really conforms to what the vision for the city is.
So one of the biggest concerns that I always hear is that there's simply too much development, too many apartments going up and too many trees being cut down, and it's all happening too fast. So can you explain why development is happening so quickly right now in this community?
That is an understandable perception. I moved here in 1996, and there was no Target. Military cutoff and Eastwood were both two-lane roads, and we sat in traffic for a long, long time to get to the beach. And it has felt really fast that things have grown up. A part of that is because Interstate 40 had just been finished in 1990, and so people discovered Wilmington. And everyone who moves here, as we all know, it's a wonderful place to live. So whoever moves here can't be the last person to move here. We have to prepare for more growth as people discover Wilmington and take advantage of the natural beauty and the culture and all the great gifts that we have, the natural gifts as well as the historic preservation of our beautiful town.
So I've talked to a few residents who are concerned about this level of development we're talking about and getting their thoughts and worries. And I just want to share some of those questions and concerns with you. So first of all, let's talk about the development pattern. I'm going to play you this clip from Julie, who I talked to earlier, about the comprehensive plan.
We've heard it interpreted quite often and used as high intensity, mixed use, high density. Equally so in the plans, I can find specific language and specific line item codes that talk about character preservation, aesthetic preservation, having things be continuous and congruent with adjacent neighborhoods. But then we see these final projects and they'll just strip out all the trees all the way and put up this big high metal thing next to what used to be a different aesthetic. And that is an interesting thing. I don't know if what's happening and what we're seeing in this town matches the vision of the staff and the board, because I've not asked, but they do often say, oh, this is what citizens want. They made this plan high use, high intensity mixed use. But when I talk to citizens, I mean, I beg you to find one that says, we love the way that looks. We want to look like Charlotte. Please denude all the land and cut all the trees. You're not going to find it. But yet that's what's happening. So where's the gap?
So I want your reaction to that. Where did the comprehensive plan come from, and is it something that you feel like we're following successfully?
Well, I'll start off by saying the terms in the land development codes and the comprehensive plan that are subjective are my least favorite parts of the plan. Neighborhood character and desired attributes, those are very subjective terms. So that's always going to be a struggle as we grow because at whatever lens you're looking through those words, you're going to have a different perception of what do I want to see here? What do you want to see here? So what we really try to do is take away some of those lenses that we look out of and really focus in on the laws, the codes, the density, what our city needs for the future to maintain some kind of affordability. As you know, the supply and demand naturally will raise has raised prices for housing just because there's not enough that we need more than we have. So,
I mean, I do hear a lot of folks say, I'm okay with affordable housing being built, but why are we building all these luxury apartments? And that is something that is often addressed when you have these planning commission meetings where, well, we just need more apartments, so we're going to let them build this apartment to address affordability. But then when they do get built, people say, well, these apartments are $1,600 for a studio. This isn't affordable. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, one myth that's floating out there is that local government has the power to require developers to put in workforce housing or affordable units or rent controls. We don't have that in the state of North Carolina. The local municipalities do not have that power. So we don't have any sticks, so we resort to carrots. We have density bonuses. So if they do a certain percentage of workforce housing, they get unlimited density depending on where they are. And I won't break down specific examples because we'll be here all day. Every project is different. Every zoning district is different. But those are some of the general ways that we can promote workforce housing.
But I also know that the density itself can be a major concern for a lot of folks. These sudden shifts in density that I've heard about, where you're seeing a single family neighborhood getting an apartment building built directly next to it without specifically a green barrier. She wanted to see trees between them. So let's listen to her comments on this.
It just seems like we're greenlighting a lot of things reactively because we didn't in advance say, you know what, everything here probably needs to be two stories or under.
So around these single-family neighborhoods, she's upset about seeing these really tall buildings going up, and she thinks that maybe there should be protections in place to prevent higher-density things from going into those neighborhoods. And I know that at some of the Planning Commission meetings that I've watched, you talk about how this more aggressive approach to building more apartments, more housing more quickly, is kind of what's expected in the coming years and what's been asked for. So can you talk a little bit about that perspective?
In general, We have in the city a lot of, here's a shopping center, and real close to that is a single-family housing development. Well, what we want in between those two things is something more transitional, like townhouses or apartment communities. So it's not really ideal to have single-family like right up against intense commercial uses. So you really want to break that up. And that's what I've been seeing a lot of, this infill development that is taking up some of that space so that we don't have somebody with a, you know, $700,000 home overlooking a parking lot to a retail center. So those townhouses and apartments, they really do serve that purpose of creating that barrier in between. And each zoning district, it's usually the side that has the most use, most intense use, that is required to put in a buffer or a fence. There's always some kind of streetscape. So it is important to the city planning and city council, planning commission, everybody here who lives here and loves it here. It is important to all of us that we do keep as many trees as we can. And that is difficult. And it's even more people move here, it becomes more and more difficult because we're surrounded by water, as you know, on three sides, and we can only go out so far. So we truly, truly have to go up. if we're going to get enough housing for everyone and maintain some kind of lifestyle that is not absolutely unaffordable in some of these communities you can see on the coast that no one can afford to live there except very, very wealthy people. So who's greeting them at their doctor's appointment, you know, who is waiting on them when they go to their favorite restaurant? We need everybody as part of this economy. It's not just doing the right thing for folks. It's building our economy and strengthening us as a community. All those folks are very important to our livelihood.
I will say on that note, 50% of the people who work in New Hanover County come here from outside of New Hanover County.
Right.
So we currently do have a workforce that is coming in from out of town, which contributes to traffic. So that is a significant concern.
The people driving in, increasing traffic, you are so right on with that. The further away people have to live from their workplace and from their favorite restaurant or their hairstylist or their grocery store, the more traffic is going to be on the road in general. So when we do build apartments in the center of town, it feels like, oh, where did those come from? It really does help in the greater scheme of things alleviate some of the traffic. Maybe not. It doesn't make it better. We'll never get better. Okay, that's long gone. Let's just let that go. But it can help in the future stop the bleeding a little bit. So that really does serve that purpose.
I also want to ask, people hate seeing clear cutting of undeveloped land. So what can be done about the clear cutting that happens when there's a piece of land that hasn't been developed before, all the trees get cut off? Why is it happening that way? What can the city do to prevent it? What policies currently exist to protect trees that are in these places?
Well, they can't clear cut. That's just not allowed. I want to make sure that the terms that we're using are appropriate. But the trees can't be just cut down, mowed down on an entire site. They can only be cut where the building footprint isn't. So most developers will shift their site plan around to save larger trees. And that's what we're asking as a city to do that. And that helps. Now, I will say if it's a single family, there's no protection. They could take down all the trees if I own a lot by myself. But if there's a townhouse community, there are restrictions on how many trees they can take down. And it is an opportunity to save green space by building up if you have more people there together.
I'm sure you've heard this one before, but there's concerns from citizens about whether the hearings themselves for the planning board or the planning commission or city council are fair. So one resident emailed me from the group Save Midtown Neighborhoods. His name's Robert Keith. He said he's concerned about a biased process that favors developers because they spend weeks or months working with staff to apply for a rezoning or for permits. And then the citizens just get a notification that a hearing is coming up only if they live within a certain radius of the proposed development. So what's your reaction to that claim that it's an unfair process?
Well, at the council meetings and at the commission meetings, it's not a debate. It's not about this person gets, you know, they each get a certain amount of time and, you know, they're cut off or whatever. The folks who spend many, many months putting these plans together, they are investing millions of dollars into our community and expecting certain returns and do their market research. And it's expensive to come to Planning Commission. We have a lot of requirements for site plan, and you have to know what you're doing before you come to Planning Commission. We expect the developers to know what they're doing. As far as the public hearing and the meetings themselves, the applicant and the opposition do get the same amount of time. And if I extend it for at least most chairs, if they extend it for one party, they would extend the time for another. And so we've done that. And Planning Commission has unlimited time to grill the developer. So we can take as much, Planning Commission can take as much time as we want to ask the applicant questions because we want to be thorough in our review of it. So the public hearing is part of the review and part of the, you know, what we take in to help make our recommendation, but it's not all of it. So we really do need to spend that time understanding the project.
I think for the particular development that Mr. Keith was concerned about, I watched that hearing in person, and after the fact, a lot of the residents who had come to that meeting, it was for a development on Oleander, they were upset about that questioning section where members of the Planning Commission were able to ask the developer's attorney questions because they thought that maybe those questions were intentionally leading to the correct answer, more or less. They thought that maybe the commission was trying to tee them up for the right answer. What's your thought on that implication?
Sometimes a commissioner might ask a question that way because they already know the answer and they want the public to understand. I know on the commission now, we have a real heart for public engagement and helping people understand the process. So yeah, if it seems a little weird, that line of questioning, I have seen that sometimes a commissioner knows what the answer is, but can tell that maybe some of the folks there for the public hearing need to hear it. So that I wouldn't speak specifically on any projects, but in general, that may be a case of that.
So it's not that they're trying to help the developer say the right thing. It's right. More that they're trying to say, hey, developer, can you explain this thing that these folks are clearly concerned about?
Right. And you'll notice that in the public hearing, the chair takes down the questions and asks the applicant to explain themselves. So the commission takes those questions very seriously, and they need to be addressed after the public hearing.
So speaking also to community representation, Julie brought up concerns about developers being on commissions and boards. So let's take a listen.
They're stacked boards, stacked commissions, stacked councils, and people are often connected to the industry too heavily. We need a little more citizen representation. Where's the sustainability head on the council's board and within staff?
So do you think that the boards that we have currently have appropriate representation on them?
Well, city council is obviously an elected body, so that's up to the citizens or the people who get out to vote. For the appointed ones, that those are city council decisions. They have a nominating committee. This is not the city speaking. This is me personally about to roll off the city planning commission. The more expertise we have on the planning commission, we have architect, we have engineer, we have realtor to help us understand any property valuation that might change. The more experience we have like that on the planning commission, the more valuable we can be. If it was just a bunch of people who don't even understand the codes, that wouldn't be valuable to city council, because we already have a venue for people who are just bringing their opinions or their perspectives, and we want to capture that in the public hearing, but that's not what the commission is for. So it's kind of two different purposes. And I see a lot of folks who are interested, and I really, really, from whatever perspective, from education perspective or from healthcare perspective, watch the city council and the public hearings for planning commission, look at their agendas and see what's coming up. And if you have something to say about it, you don't have to wait till it's right in your backyard. Come out any time and speak. That's what the public hearings are for. And the more active we can get those public hearings, the better.
Do you think there should be at least one person on the commission who has a more average citizen perspective, or who is specifically speaking to sustainability or the environment the way that Julie mentioned?
We have had environmental engineer on there before. We have stormwater engineer on there now. Yes, we do need all those perspectives. But just because somebody works for an architectural firm doesn't mean they don't care about the environment.
That's a fair point.
I think we all care about it because we live here.
That was J.C. Lyle, the chair of Wilmington's Planning Commission, answering questions from concerned citizens about development. Stay tuned to hear more. For WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Today, we're digging into development and the particular concerns that we hear from residents about apartments going up all over the community. Earlier this hour, I asked local resident Julie Hurley to explain her concerns, and now I'm bringing them to Wilmington Planning Commission Chair J.C. Lyle.
On Julie's concerns, she had a question about what she called loopholes in city and county codes. So here's what she had to say.
I don't know. I think we should decide in advance where rezoning can't happen and where it can happen. And right now, it's rezoning every single project that's getting rezoned. Of course, the loophole for the developer is, instead of making money on 60 market price / luxury units, I'll give them 3 token affordable workforce housing. Then I can go up and out and I can do unlimited density, so the bonus density thing. And then also, if you put a little commercial in, then all of a sudden you go up 4 stories. And so they can make more money. They're already making plenty of money, but now you can even make more money. And I like making more money. It's not that. It's just the cost and the impacts to the community. And right now, what we're working with is super favorable environment for the developers.
What's your reaction to that?
Wow, I have a lot of reactions to that. Let me start with the workforce housing. incentive that she brought up. That is a carrot that we have to get the workforce units. And it requires 10% of the units to be reserved as workforce housing. And it does, in many zoning districts, include unlimited density. And the developers really need that to make the project pencil, which means they put together their pro forma and they go get money from a financial institution. They have to show that there's a return on it. So, yes, the developers do have to make a profit on paper and in reality, because this is America and that's okay.
I do think her concern there is that it's just such a small number of apartments that are workforce housing. What's your reaction to that?
She's not wrong. 10% of one project is not that much. 10% around the city, in my opinion, as a person who's in social services in addition to housing and development, having the workforce housing scattered around the city is so much better, personally, I feel, than shoveling everybody into one area that's lower income. Now, we do have that, and it's critical to fulfilling the need for tax credit projects, and we do have some of those projects that create a lot more volume for affordability, but we also need projects scattered around the city so people can get to where they live and live where they work, hopefully. We also have been incentivizing accessory dwelling units, ADUs, and missing middle, like putting townhouses in and duplexes. And some of the incentives we put in the codes in 2021 are really starting to be fruitful. And we're so excited. One of the last meetings we had, just over 100 units of housing come through, and I always count that up every meeting, and over 80 of the units were missing middle, which means like in between single family houses and apartments. So these are the duplexes and the townhouses and the transitional development patterns.
So that makes it less intensive and less
right.
overwhelming compared to these apartment buildings, right?
In theory.
Is that the idea?
That's right. So
I guess the idea that I'm hearing from concerns like this is it really worth it to have this small number of workforce apartments if we're going to give them so many more apartments to build? And what's your reaction to that phrasing of it?
Well, everybody needs a place to live. And every unit that's built is affordable to somebody. And we're not going to stop people from moving here by building fewer homes. People are going to still move here. And the more people that move here, the greater imbalance we have in demand and supply, the higher the rates are going to go for housing. So let's just stop the bleeding if we can, incentivize as much as we can. Again, we don't have, as a municipality, we don't have the power to force people to control their rents or to force people to build units that are affordable to a certain income level. So that's the best we can do.
Just a hope for the market to kind of figure itself out and give incentives for more affordable apartments.
Right, and have subsidies. There are a lot of subsidies for housing that isn't met by the market needs so much because it's really expensive to build in this area right now. All the good land is gone. There's always an issue with the land that they're going to build on, whether it's an infill or a new site. So,
this is something that I've heard on the more extreme end, and it's not something that's the representative view of either Robert or Julie, but I have heard this exact phrase a few times. Let's put a moratorium on development. I don't want to see anything new getting built here. Why can't we do that as a city?
We could do that.
We could?
Sure.
How? Is it legal?
Well, I know people do it, like if their sewer system can't keep up or things like that, because there are controls at the local level for that. But I don't know that that's in the best interest of the city. Again, we're not going to stop people from moving here. Stopping development altogether, I don't know how long that people were interested in doing that. but stopping that altogether means no new stores, no new restaurants. No, you know, if you want to open up a mom and pop's grocery store, or it means that none of that is going to happen. We're kind of frozen in time. And that's not what cities do. Like that is the death of a city. And the housing is going to be so expensive. And people are going to fight over the land. I mean, it would create more problems than it would solve.
Gotcha. So we can't roll up the bridge, stop people from moving here, and stop all development.
That's right.
So what is your vision for Wilmington's future?
Well, one of the most important trends I think people are learning as we create these codes and visions for the city, ages ago, they used to separate out single-family homes from commercial, from apartments. And frankly, that was more of a socioeconomic, it was a caste system. Because you're keeping people who can't afford a home away from you, because you want the people who can't afford what you have, you don't want them living next door, right? So that's where it came from, the separation of all these uses.
Quick editor's note. Lyle emailed me later to clarify she didn't mean this to mean current residents, but instead to talk about historic patterns of segregation dating back to the 1920s to 1960s. She said, "We've lived in this exclusionary zoning for so long that it seems normal now." All right, back to the interview.
Some towns that are more progressive don't even have single-family districts anymore. You can build apartments, townhouses, you know, wherever.
Portland and Minneapolis being really big examples of that.
Great. The cities of the future are going to have a more integrated approach. So, for example, Julie brought up the commercial and having just a little token amount of commercial in the multifamily developments to meet a certain code. And she's talking about the commercial district mixed use. It was designed to kind of break away from that caste system and to put people close to services. So originally, if you just build a multifamily and you have a certain amount of commercial you have to add in there for it to be truly mixed use. But if you're in the middle of town and you've got a grocery store a quarter of a mile away and a shopping center, you don't have to build all that commercial underneath because it's already there. So let's look at not just this one piece of property, but let's look at what's all around the town, what's in the quarter of a mile, what people can walk to, and let's build houses there, build apartments or townhouses or whatever. In those areas so that people can walk. The cities of the future are going to be more walkable. I mean, think about how many places you can walk to from your house.
Well, I live downtown, so it's not too bad.
Yes, when I live downtown, I can walk to all kinds of things. That's the city of the future. Actually, the city of the past, I guess, is the city of the future because so many of our cities are built for cars. And what I would like to see, because I'm also a health nut, is the cities that are built for walking. I live in Masonboro. I can't walk to anything. I don't even have sidewalks. I walk my dog in the road. So I would love to see more integration and getting rid of that caste system and putting human beings living next to other human beings in a place that is functional and that people can walk to services and their job, maybe.
I mean, I know that's a tough one for the Planning Commission because you have limitations to the amount of transportation infrastructure you can require or build or put around developments that aren't things you're currently looking at applications for.
That's right.
So I know that Wilmington is a little famous for its lack of connectivity between bike facilities and pedestrian facilities. But that's a future conversation, perhaps.
That's right. We've had some bonds, so that's a good start.
Yes.
I will say, because we've touched on affordable housing a little bit and workforce housing issues, and I will say this. We have a serious affordable housing crisis, and we need to behave like it. It wasn't created by developers. It wasn't created by one town. It's not unique to Wilmington that, we have this affordable housing crisis. It was created over decades of unfair policies, of social issues, of that caste system I mentioned in land development codes. It's not going to be solved by developers. It's not going to be solved by city government. It's going to be solved by all of us stepping up. And honestly, my favorite way for everyone to step up is to tip more. Just be as generous as you can. Be a crazy tipper, because that is how you make it personal. The affordable housing crisis is in your area. Make it personal. The people that you see every day that are relying on you to pay their rent, give them an extra dollar. Make it personal, even if their service is mediocre. And because everybody needs a home. So that's why the affordable housing crisis is a symptom and a cause of so many other social issues because it affects every human being. So we can't expect to build our way out of it. We can't expect to have developers solve the crisis for us. They're certainly part of the solution, so we need to treat them like that and stop demonizing them for wanting to create, you know, a new development or that is near them or to create a profit for their families and their workers. So I really feel like it's past time for us to all get together and attack this affordable housing crisis as a community and not attack each other.
Well, J.C. Lyle, current and soon-to-be former head of the Planning Commission, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Kelly, and for the great work you do here at the station.
Thank you. That's about all the time we have left for the newsroom. Thank you for listening. Thanks to my guests, Julie Hurley and J.C. Lyle, and to Robert Keith for his notes. Thanks also to my editor, Ben Schachman, and programming manager, Ken Campbell. If you have questions about today's programming or ideas for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or get the show as a podcast pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks again for listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media.